where Poland is now and its future by talking a bit about the immediate past. And our guest this morning is Michael Kaufman. He was a reporter for the New York Times in Poland for a number of years. He, in fact, was a foreign correspondent for the Times from 75 until 89 and served as bureau chief in Nairobi, in New Delhi, in Ottawa, and then finally in Warsaw. His connection to Poland is not only professional, it is also personal. His father was born in Poland, was involved with the Polish Communist Party there before the Second World War, was jailed for his activities, eventually left and ended up in the United States. Michael Kaufman himself was born in Paris and came to the United States in 1941. So he does have a personal connection to Poland, speaks Polish, and was able to get to know a number of people involved in Solidarity and a great many other Polish people, and has written a book that conveys, I think, an unusual and deep understanding of that nation. His book is entitled Mad Dreams, Saving Graces, Poland, a Nation in Conspiracy, and has been recently published by Random House. And he's talking with us this morning. If you have some questions as we talk, you're welcome to call in and talk with Mr. Kaufman. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Just remember that the exchange differs between the two. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Kaufman, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
I'm delighted to be here.
It seems, at least to me as a somewhat casual observer, that that what has happened in Poland in the last couple of months with the Solidarity victories in the elections, now with the Solidarity person as the Prime Minister, it seems astounding. To you as a more seasoned observer who is in fact there as some of the groundwork for what we see now was laid, does it seem as astounding to you? Could you have predicted it?
Well, I did predict a lot of it in the book. The book was finished a year ago, and I did know when I must tell you that there was a time when I was a correspondent in Poland, and I was getting messages from from people who are saying, "Hey, you're concentrating too much on these Solidarity guys. They're finished. It's over. You're a romantic. What is needed is something else." And I just kept reporting the activities and the hopes and the dreams of my friends who are either in hiding or sometimes in jail. And I did it not because I'm wise and brilliant. I did it for two reasons. One, because I like them, because they were fun to be with. They were more fun to be with than you know, they were countercultural, and they represented my own, they were younger, and they were daring, and they were fun. But more importantly, because I knew that the party was an extremist, that despite its huffing and puffing, they would have to ultimately reckon with these people, because there was no one else. There was no one to surrender to. The country should be seen as a besieged, war-damaged country that has never emerged from the first crisis, which began exactly 50 years ago, the day after tomorrow, when the Germans first invaded Poland to begin World War II, and 2 weeks later the Russians took the other half. So in that perspective, I'm not surprised. But I'm talking a bit much, but I'll stop in a second. The other perspective, however, of exactly how quickly they have attained power. My view had been that they would want 4 or 5 years to learn democracy, that they wanted to be in opposition. They did not wish to take power. And that, I think, had been everybody's hope. But no one fully realized how weak the other side was, how quick decay was coming in the communist world. And you can't go into Parliament as an opposition party and then tie your own hands behind your back and say, "Hey, we really don't aspire to power." So they had to, you know, act as an opposition which seeks power, and the others sort of crumbled. And they've gotten it long before I think they really want it.
I suppose the danger here is that now that they're in the driver's seat, so to speak, there are great expectations of them, and that many Polish people must have a limited store of patience. And the question is, can Solidarity manage to achieve some significant gains before that store of patience runs out.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's fraught with dangers, but I keep saying to myself that if you look at the perspective of 50 years, this is marvelous. If you look at the perspective of the last 3 months, this is tricky at best. But if the money comes from the West, today there's a letter in the New York Times by the German president explaining what happened 50 years ago, a letter he had written to Jaruzelski apologizing, in a sense, again apologizing. I think that will be followed up by German investment. I think the Russians are willing to see the West put money in. I think the when Bush comes back from Kennebunkport, he's going to have to deal with how much more can he give Poland. 100 million is not enough. I think if you get a consortium of Western Europe and in fact the willingness of the Soviets for the first time too, and 50 years ago Europe came apart over Poland when Poland came apart. Now it seems a new Europe is being built, and resources have to come from outside. Poland lacks the resources to stabilize itself. And yet, if it doesn't stabilize itself, then I think European stability is endangered. And therefore, it becomes an international problem, and I think that that is the hope. If solidarity can anchor hope for a little while, and you ask people to make sacrifices a little bit, and if help comes in, it's a frail hope. I'm not too optimistic, but I think there are possibilities that simply didn't exist 2 or 3 years ago, and they're great.
Does it seem to you that Poland is, in a sense, the Soviet bloc in microcosm?
Well, it isn't in the sense that the Soviet bloc, the Soviet Union, for example, is a multinational entity and therefore faces a whole other range of problems. Poland is 98% Polish and 98% Catholic, and so that isn't a problem. But to the extent that the Soviet Union is looking for something of a way out, and the major formula that Gorbachev has announced is glasnost for perestroika. We will give you freedom to participate in your destiny, and you will work harder and make more sacrifices. That's the only thing we can figure out and move towards modernity. That process has gone further in Poland and was initiated earlier in Poland than anywhere else. So to some extent, Gorbachev is looking at Poland. I think he's looking, it's a mixed blessing. If this works, and certainly what has happened in Poland has led to the new unrest in the Baltic republics, it may have led or encouraged the coal mining strikes in the Ukraine, which I think are probably things that the Soviet Union is, and even Gorbachev finds, coming very close to a price he can no longer pay for that, for even the hope of modernity. Security will overwhelm, at some point, security concerns for the Soviet Union will overwhelm the yearnings for modernity, and then we could face a sort of rollback in this whole process. But at the moment, Poland is the vanguard.
Our guest this morning is Michael Kaufman. He's the author of the book Mad Dreams, Saving Graces, Poland, a Nation in Conspiracy. He reported on Eastern Europe for the New York Times from 1984 until last year. If you have questions as we talk about Poland, you can call. We do have one person here we'll get right to. Our local lines are open. That number is 333-9455. The toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have somebody on there, so let's talk to them right now. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello. I am interested in the connection with solidarity with the Catholic Church, and is there any connection with solidarity within the rise of the Catholic Right movement in Europe? I'm speaking of something like Le Pen or the Archbishop Lefebvre, and I'll go ahead and hang up and wait for your reply.
Okay, well, that's an interesting question. Obviously, Catholicism has a long history, and the movement for Polish independence and national resurgence really dates from the day that the Pope, a Pole, was elected in Rome. That gave confidence to the nation. Now, there are tendencies in the Polish Catholic Church, and there are tendencies in solidarity, and there are tendencies in the government that run the whole gamut of Christian Democrat, what would be Christian Democrat, would be kind of a papist party, all the way down to social democracy and theology of liberation. Theology of liberation has its has, in fact, that word is used by the Polish Council of Bishops. So, as far as Solidarity is concerned, there is many streams that fed Solidarity, some secular, some former communists, some former socialists, some rather Christian and rather Catholic. The Prime Minister now, Mazowiecki, comes from the Catholic tradition, but has very close friends and alliances with people like the Committee to Defend Workers, which was a precursor of Solidarity, which was in large measure the creation of Jacek Kuron and Anna Michnik, who come from a secularist tradition. There are, furthermore, a number of people in Solidarity who are known to be of Jewish origin, and that is sometimes used against them, harking back to certain anti-Semitic echoes. I don't want to make too much of that. I think it's erroneous and vulgar and stupid to perceive the entire Polish nation of 37 million as perpetually and chronically and inevitably anti-Semitic. They are not. They are no more so than the United States is chronically, perpetually, and forever just racist, although one cannot deny that there is racism in our is a major stream in our social life. So the answer to the question is there are these tendencies. They have come up briefly during the last 6 years. They have raised their head. For instance, in the Solidarity movement, there was a group called the True Poles, who reflected some pen-like views. They were shot down by Wałęsa himself. Recently, as you know, or you may know, the primate of Poland made some, I think, very ill thought out remarks about the about Jews and their opposition to the convent at Auschwitz, and the Solidarity newspaper immediately repudiated those remarks and said that they gave true offense and were very hurtful. So there are these streams, and there is a dynamism, and nobody's a monolith. So that's all I can tell you.
Well, one of the things that you write about in the book, the fact that everybody in Poland remembers where they were and what they were doing and how they found out about martial law being declared, that it's a very key moment in the life of Poles, and that perhaps with the benefit of hindsight, many people feel that the martial law crackdown really worked in the favor of Solidarity, that it in fact was good for the movement to be driven underground, and that perhaps that was what made the events of today possible. You think that is the case?
Well, I would, from my distance, think that was the case, but I would also argue that no one put me in jail, no one took anybody from my family and put them away. When we look at the events of Tiananmen Square, and we realize that there are crackdowns. Tiananmen Square, young kids asking for freedom in China end up being shot, killed, maimed, destroyed with tanks. In Poland, thousands were put in jail. Thousands were taken from their families. It was a declaration of war upon the nation. I think, having said that in fact, there's one man in my book who I cite, a Solidarity figure, who sort of laments about Jaruzelski, and he said, "I guess he's never learned his Machiavelli very well. He declared war on us, and therefore won the condemnation of the nation." On the other hand, having done that, he didn't really eliminate us. Therefore, he was too kind and not kind enough. So he's in this hard spot. I do think that having gone underground and I think this is what awaits the Chinese now, having passed the test of conspiracy, although conspiracy is very much in Poland's national history, the character of Poland, having learned to put out publications, having created a civic society, a civil society, having sort of created pluralistic institutions that, even if they were just theaters, plays, seized the cultural life, seized the historical life from the state monopolies that had been dominating those spheres, they forced this new, they matured. They learned how to deal politically with their own rivalries within the movement. They learned how to compromise. These are things that are, you know, if you haven't practiced democracy for 40 years, you may understand its theory, but it's really hard to put into practice how we share, how we merge different opinions. And they had to do that. And they had these 8 years since, 7 years since 1981, to learn and to practice and to develop leaders. And I think that that now is what will be happening in China. And I think it's a way out.
When you got to Warsaw, it was a couple of years after martial law, and so the opposition had the opportunity to get fairly experienced. And one gets the impression from reading the book that almost everyone in some way, maybe not formally, but in some way was involved in doing anti-government activities, and hence this subtitle, I think, that's where it comes from, this idea of the nation in conspiracy. In what sort of ways was that expressed, and does that continue to be expressed by the Poles?
Well, it ranged. It's an interesting point. Conspiracy and resistance is part of Poland's civic national religion. Uprisings of the 19th century. Poland disappeared in 1795, didn't reappear again until 1918. So generations have taken their place at the barricades. That's an obligation of Polish nationalism, patriotism, and citizenship. The most recent heroic uprising was the Warsaw Uprising in the closing days of World War II, when Warsaw, the partisans of Warsaw, rose against the Germans and watched their city destroyed block by block, but yet held out for suffering colossal losses. So that was the memory. The memory was, okay, here we are, we'll take up guns. And yet, after Budapest in 1956, I think a recognition has permeated mass consciousness, and that is that military uprisings, in the technology, when it's guns against guns and horses against horses and sabers against sabers, it's still very difficult. But when it's guns against tanks, it's impossible. So a new methodology had to be found, and no one knew what that would be. And here were these guys. My book starts off by tracing the lives of five people who escaped the dragnet and who had the responsibility to figure out, well, what do we do now? Do we pick up machine guns? Do we sabotage the telephone lines? And they evolved a methodology that was said, no, let us encourage society to do whatever it is that they want to do. If high school kids want to put out a newspaper, let us teach them how to do that. Let us show them how to print. Let us show them how to run radio stations. Let us encourage, eventually we're going to need apartments for those of us who are being sought in this underground society that was emerging. Well, there was a bureau that developed to locate. They kept moving every 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks they would change their apartments. They'd be about, I guess, 100 such people, maybe a little more. But they needed supplies. They needed paper. They needed identification cards. And out of this evolved a network. I don't know if everyone was involved. I think what we will find in the future is that everyone will have said they were involved, because certainly these were the Jesse James heroes of the nation, defying a formal state that was increasingly seen, it had always been seen as repressive, now it was seen as incompetent and weak and frail and funny. I mean, the humor had a lot to do with ridiculing these leaders who pretended to be much more powerful than it turned out that they were.
Yeah. We have another caller here again on our toll-free line. We'll talk with them. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wonder if you could do this for me. Could you take the problem in two parts, rural and industrial, and would you tell me in small increments just exactly how you think they're going to process themselves in these two areas into a democracy?
Okay, that's a very good question. Again, in my book, I do deal with the farm and the city. One thing we ought to realize is that before the war, Poland was 70% rural and 30% urban, and now it's the reverse. So an enormous transformation has taken place with communist, remember, the communist ideology placed the industrial proletariat as the vanguard, as what was that was the best class to belong to. And the farms were, well, particularly since in Poland they never succeeded in nationalizing the farms, so the peasants were very much what Stalin used to call kulaks. They were private peasants. It was an ideological confusion as to what we do with the countryside. On the other hand, they knew enough that the conditions in Poland wouldn't permit nationalization of the farms, and that's one of the ways that Polish communism has been aberrant all along. So how is it going to work? Well, the problem in the countryside is that you have canny, strong peasants who do feed the nation and have succeeded, rather small holdings, but they are held by the throat by an administration and a bureaucracy which is party-run and party-controlled. And that means that if you need inputs like fertilizer, if you need coal, you go through some party hack in your little provincial town. If you need credit from the bank, that bank is run by some party hack who shouldn't be seen in ideological terms. I mean, he may never have read Marx, probably doesn't even know, you know, thinks of Marx as some bizarre abstraction. But he's a mafioso member. He is not going to give up his privileges. His privileges come from saying no, not from saying yes. And he has, no matter what they say in Warsaw, the parliament can act in Warsaw. Even his party superiors in Warsaw can say, hey, look, guy, the times have changed. We got to get together, and if we, you know, we're going to be hanging from lampposts unless you guys start accommodating popular opinion in your area. But he's been lining his pockets with bribes. He's been has his own little. He's got lines of to the local police, who are also the party members. And that's the obstructionist problem. How to replace the high school principal is probably another member of this cabal. And one of that's the difficulty. That's going to be very difficult. It also applies in the cities, but not as much. In the countryside, these guys have real enormous powers, and their powers are all involved with saying no, not saying yes. You've got an entrepreneur who wants to, I write in the book about a guy who wants to produce cinder blocks in the countryside. Everybody wants cinder blocks. The government wants him to produce cinder blocks, but these guys are keeping him from producing cinder blocks unless he starts paying bribes. He refuses to pay bribes, and you can see how this whole operation works. It's not too much different from a rural countryside in a corrupt county, say, where the bosses are all, you know, in collusion with the coal miners or whatever. But this is the way it works all over the country, and that's going to be a real problem. The only thing I can say about the hopeful sign there is that these guys are not ideological, and if they see which way the wind is blowing, they're opportunists. These are corrupt people. But by being corrupt, they will perhaps bend and flee from one group to the other. As far as the industry goes, there's another enormous problem. Because of the Soviet model, some years ago, the emphasis had been on putting investments into huge enterprises, huge chemical plants, coal mines, steel mills, for the Russian market. All of those are ineffective. The best thing you can do in 80% of them, I think, is close them down. But if you close them down, you throw out of work precisely the same people who have been supporting Solidarity. So Solidarity has this enormous problem. To reform the economy, it has to hurt its own social base. I doubt it can do that without offering some incentives, and that's where the West comes in. I think politically, money from the West to refinance. Remember, Poland was asked to join the Marshall Plan, and it accepted at the time of the Marshall Plan. It accepted for one day, and then Stalin picked up the phone and said, no way. And so it turned down that acceptance. It reversed itself. In a sense, I think what we need now is to give them another chance to rebuild a war-damaged economy.
Well, may I ask you this one question?
Sure.
Are you speaking in terms of deindustrializing Poland?
Not deindustrializing Poland, but joint ventures, smaller businesses, create privatization, bring in as much know-how and expertise, rebuilding the communication system, which is woefully inadequate, sort of infrastructural work, and also removing the impediments and bringing in the investments that would create a new kind of industry. No, I'm not talking about closing down coal mines.
Are the Polish people entrepreneurial in spirit?
You know, there's a long argument about that. The Poles have not had a bourgeois revolution. They are like the American South. Their leadership has always been this gentry class. Impoverished rural gentry have been set the standards for the nation, standards of grace, which are wonderful if you're going to live in defiance and in opposition. They're not the virtues you need to build a hard-working, Protestant ethic kind of state. But I would also argue against that, is when Poles come to this country, or when they go to Germany to work, they work very, very hard. There was a joke all the years that I was in Poland saying, you know, the joke was the government pretends to pay us, so we pretend to work. Well, if you have an oppressive government, then not working well for absentee landlords is an expression of patriotism. If you are masters in your own home, I think the Poles can and will show the kind of spirit and entrepreneurial spirit that others have when it is in their interest to do so,
when they
can do it.
All right.
Thank you.
This morning on Focus, we're talking with Michael Kaufman. He covered Poland for the New York Times for a number of years and has written a book about his experiences, Mad Dreams, Saving Graces. We'll continue in a moment. He has written a book about his experiences, Mad Dreams, Saving Graces, Poland, a Nation in Conspiracy. It's published by Random House. If you have some questions for our guest, 333-9455 is the local number, and toll-free anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We do have another caller who's been waiting patiently here, and we will talk with them on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Are you familiar with the high-level rapprochement meeting that took place in Budapest, Hungary on October 8th of 1986 between Roman Catholic scholars and the communist leaders from several countries?
Right. I was there at the time. I do remember that meeting, yes.
You were there, huh?
Well, I didn't attend the meeting, but I was in Budapest when that was happening.
Do you remember what happened as the result of that? Did the Roman Catholic Church censure Father Balagny?
Right, and there was a question of whether resistance in the arm to military was whether draft resistance was an exercise of conscience or not. Is that the one?
That's the one, right. And the Roman Catholic Church did censure Father Balagny. Is that correct?
They I think did in that conference. I don't want to say categorically because I'm not really that much up on it, but yeah, I remember the Father Balagny was not happy with the outcome.
What I read an article about that in the October 8th, 1986 issue of the Wall Street Journal. I clipped it because of the interest of it, and it said all communist roads lead to Rome.
The what?
All communist roads lead to Rome.
Well,
but what was interesting in that was that they were speaking of the healing of East-West relations could take place as a result of the Communist Church and the Roman Catholic Church cooperating with one another. Communists would realize that some of their pressing society needs can be met by Roman Catholic cooperation in society.
I think that's an oversimplification, and I think the church is also not the monolith we sometimes perceive it as. I believe that in Poland, which I know better than Hungary, there is a marked difference between the traditions that the primate represents and the traditions that the Pope himself represents within the Polish Catholic Church, and that the primate's interests are much more parochial, much more narrow, and he's much more willing to protect property and deal with parochial issues and what happens for the day when the Pope no longer is a Pole than is the Pope, who after all is Catholic and universal Catholic in the other sense. So you know, yes, the church is also Father Balagny in a sense. I mean, he may be in this particular context, he may have been chastised, but his voice is also raised. In Prague, there is a magnificent priest named Father Václav Mali, M-A-L-Y, who has been delicensed by the powers that be, because they license priests there. And to my mind, he and Václav Havel have been leading an incredibly wonderful crusade for national honor and escape from a absurd totalitarian system. So I think it's wrong to see them as monoliths. They do have the church, like other institutions, has its interests that may not always coincide with the interests of the people they serve, the immediate interests of the people they serve. But I do think that it's an oversimplification to talk of the church and the communists as co-equal oppressors.
I didn't say that. All I said was that they were cooperating for the help of taking care of some of the society pressures. I mean, because Father Bellani believed in, he stated that people should be conscientious objectors, and the Roman Catholics censured him for other reasons than that.
Right.
But basically, they both had he was a thorn in both of their fleshes.
Right.
But what I'm asking is, do you think that the communist countries are becoming more accepting of the Roman Catholic Church and realize that they can be more cooperative? I'm not putting down communism now. I hope you don't.
Okay.
See, I'm not saying either. I'm just wondering if they are cooperative.
Well, let me point out that of the countries where Catholicism is a major force, Poland is one, Hungary is another. Czechoslovakia tends not to be. I mean, they're the Baltic republics. There is the Catholics. There are some Lithuania, and although some are Lutheran, and in the Ukraine there is a Unia Church, which is Eastern Rite but recognizes the Pope, and that's an underground church. So I think that one wedge in which communist totalitarianism can and is retreating is making overtures to the church, and that probably is the least painful way to signal change. That once you imprison Mindszenty in Hungary, and then you end up talking to his successors, that signals for the West and for the world a change. And I think that is happening. That is happening.
Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the program that you had a personal connection with Poland because your father was born there. And that while you were in Warsaw, as a reporter, he came to visit you a couple of times. And I wonder whether his presence, walking the streets with him, somehow helped you to understand Poland a little bit better, or maybe understand your father better.
Well, I've been under his spell for a long time, long before I ever went to Poland. I tell in the book about an incident where we were in New York going to visit, I was 8 years old or 9 years old, we visited friends, and that night he was with this company, and he used the Polish word to sit, siedzieć, in a way I had never heard it used before. And somebody said, oh, how long did you sit with him? And then he said, oh, 2 years. And then somebody said, oh, was she sitting there at the same time? And in the same way that a kid realizes that about sex before he knows it's about sex, I suddenly realized that my father was talking about being in jail. At that time, I used to listen to Gangbusters and had the rather conventional belief that bad people went to jail and good people put them there. And here was the best man I'd ever met. And it turned out he'd spent 9 years in jail and there were hunger strikes. So in that sense, I learned whatever grace I have, or I aspired to a grace that was, I think, beyond me, but through the example set to me by my father, who suffered for an idea he no longer holds, and for one, he was thrown out of the party, thank God, in 1932, but there were suicide attempts, there was hunger strikes, there was torture, there was honor. And that part was very much in the Polish character, not necessarily in the name of communism, which could be seen as a false road, a God that failed kind of thing. But in terms of not talking to the police, in terms of withstanding torture, in terms of fighting for a better world, those had echoes in the Polish romantic past that go way, way back. And so when I got to Poland, I recognized that in New York, I had a pretty good story. I had a pretty good genealogical tale to tell, and I could impress my girlfriends with this saga of escape, crossing borders illegally, coming to the United States as a refugee during the war. But in Poland, I realized everybody over 45 had a story at least as good. What it did do for me, though, was that when my father was thrown out of the party, he was still in prison, and he slashed his wrist. He had 2 years to serve. And after he was sewed up by prison doctors, he was put in a cell with another man who was his party enemy, but who in that context turned out to be fairly decent and human, and they taught each other poetry. That man then went on, survived the war, and had a son after the war, whose name is Adam Michnik, who is the most articulate, I think, champion of Solidarity, now the editor of its newspaper and a member of parliament. When I got to Poland, he was in jail, this being Poland. This being in jail because of his anti-communist struggles. I managed to send a message into him, write him a note, he telling him that I was there, asking him, I didn't know if he knew who I was. He messaged me back, Poland being a police state, but a sloppy police state. He was able to message me back that he knew exactly who I was, that he welcomed me, and that his father had told him about my father. And he, in a sense, when he came out 2 months later in an amnesty, he became my guide into the world of resistance and conspiracy, and I, through him, met most of the people who are now taking the leadership, who at that time were in clandestine conspiracy.
It's a remarkable story.
Yeah.
Let's go to another call here, line two. Hello.
Yes, hello. We've been talking about the need in Poland's economy for Western credits. And, I have a lot of friends in the Polish expatriate community, and they're very eager to see the West provide this money to Poland. But I think, on the other hand, in the West, there's certainly the attitude of we can't give this money to the government. We have the economic disaster that happened in the 70s all over again. So really the question is, who do we give the money to?
Right. It's a key question, and obviously, what we need is a lot of private money. I mean, what we need is joint ventures with very stringent objectives. Poland has a few resources to sell in the world, not the least of which is an intelligent and highly trained technical workforce, right on up to engineers and chemists. I would argue from the other position, okay, I agree that there are enormous economic risks in giving that money. But there are even greater political risks if we don't give that money. And I would argue that if in 1992, as is now planned, Western Europe does manage some kind of economic confederation, which is the plan, it will be a competitor with the United States and with Japan. It will be a real massive player. It already is. If that happens, I can conceive of a Europe in which the Germans will be the hegemonic power. That seems to be unavoidable in any case. German hegemony in the next century seems to be foreordained, not unlike Japanese hegemony in the Orient, economic hegemony in the East. So the Germans will be there. The Russians will be there as a neighbor because they can't, they're not going to move physically. They're going to be where they are. And we're going to be 3,000 miles away without any role to play. If That is so. That's not a particularly great prospect. I also submit that 50 years after World War II, having Germany as the dominant power, the economic power in Europe, unchecked, is also not terrific as far as I'm concerned. So it seems to me that we get the most bang for our buck. Where do we get it? We get it in Eastern Europe, where we are most, where because things are so bad, a little money will go a very long way. That's one. And two, we are beloved. Not always, I never understood exactly why, but we are the heroes in Eastern Europe. We are the nation that has the most clout, that is most admired, that is the model. And it would be squandering that resource, I think, not to come in some way. But I do agree that we ought to put very tight strictures on how we come in and not to support another consumerist wave, but put it into some real investments for that would be useful.
I'm not so much concerned about, say, a consumerist wave. I'm more concerned with, say, you know, a bunch of credit going into steel factories and large chemical plants and things like that. That you know, just
right.
All the Western industrialized countries are having trouble competing with the likes of South Korea in that making steel and
absolutely. I don't think that what you have to do is reallocate your workforce from the shipyards to smaller, more technologically competitive, maybe back to Wards in the garment district. I mean, you know, really, Wards is Manchester, antiquated machinery, but a large female workforce. I don't know. I really don't know enough about the textile markets in the world, but it seems to me as an entrepot economy for a new united Europe. It is the poorest country in Europe. We've got a third world country with first world aspirations. And with some first-world technological skills. And that's probably the only one of its kind I can think of in the world. And its position in Europe between East and West can, I think, be exploited. I certainly think that if we don't, the Germans will. And that's really the question, isn't it?
We just have about 2 or 3 minutes left, and I'm sorry because the conversation is fascinating, and I wish we could continue, but when it comes to the end, that's the point we have to stop. I would like to have you talk a little bit about the death of Father Papiushko. It was probably, as we judge news stories, the biggest story to happen during the time that you were in Poland.
Right.
He was a young activist priest, very outspoken, very very popular. Why was his death a significant event in the?
Well, besides the fact that it mobilized the nation, I think it alarmed Jaruzelski to recognize until that. The death of Father Papiushko, Jaruzelski had been doing sort of a zigzag, very slow zigzag tactical course, trying to appease the hardliners in his own party, the liberals in his own party, try to remove Western sanctions, trying to keep the Russians happy, all of which meant one step backward, one step forward. When Father Papiushko was killed, I think he recognized that there was a greater threat to him from his own hardliners than there was from the national opposition of Solidarity. And he moved rather forcefully, purged the interior ministry, put his own man in charge, and put the four guys on public trial. We never did find out who really was behind it above those four, but all of those were innovations, and they kept the lid on, and which could have boiled over if he had acted in another way.
What do people think of General Jaruzelski?
What do they think of him?
Mm-hmm. The Polish people.
I think there's growing ambivalence. On one hand, they're beginning grudgingly to recognize that he's a different communist leader than all the others. He comes from this aristocratic gentry, not aristocratic, but sort of minor gentry. He was a Catholic in his childhood. He is a general. Communists aren't supposed to be led by generals. The army is supposed to serve the party, not lead it. But his patriotism, which was questioned, is, I think, a little less questioned. I think I'll go out on a limb and guess that in the years to come, he will gain respect of the nation. They're still upset that he declared war on them. It's a stigma he'll never fully escape. But he did bring about this accommodation.
Well, we will leave it at that. Thank you very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Okay.
For those of you who are interested in reading more on this subject, I suggest you take a look at our guest's book. It's Mad Dreams Saving Graces. That's the title. It's published by Random House. Michael Kaufman is the author.